From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. President Trump declared a national emergency along the U.S.-Mexico border, but did the president make it sound like much of an emergency?
I could do the wall over a longer period of time. I didn't need to do this, but I'd rather do it much faster. And I don't have to do it for the election. I've already done a lot of wall for the election, 2020.
The former head of U.S. Customs and Border Protection tells us what he thinks of walls, and a conservative who says the decision shows politics is broken. And stock car racing, Bubba Wallace will talk about how he hopes to bring new fans to NASCAR. Fasten your seatbelts for our newscast. It's Saturday, February 16, 2019.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Just days before a global summit at the Vatican on clerical sex abuse, a high-profile Roman Catholic figure has been expelled from the priesthood. Former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick had risen to a high position of power in the American church, but NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports McCarrick has now been defrocked.
At the end of a penal process, the Vatican Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith announced it had found McCarrick guilty of solicitation in the sacrament of confession and having sex with minors and adults with the aggravating factor of abuse of power. The decree was approved by Pope Francis and there's no appeal. Rumors of McCarrick's sexual relations with seminarians had circulated for years. Last spring, allegations were made that he had abused a minor more than 50 years ago. In July, on the Pope's orders, McCarrick became the first Catholic prelate in nearly 100 years to lose the title of cardinal. Since then, he's been living in seclusion in a friary in Kansas. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
California among those planning legal action over President Trump's declaration of a national emergency to fund a border wall, from member station KQED in San Francisco. Peter John Schuller reports.
Governor Gavin Newsom and Attorney General Javier Becerra discussed their plans to join other states in a lawsuit at a news conference. It was just hours after President Trump declared a national emergency to stop what he called an invasion of drugs, human traffickers, and gangs. Becerra said there is no emergency and called Trump's action frivolous and an overreach of the president's authority.
No one in America is above the law. Not even the president of the United States.
Governor Newsom, who called the wall a monument to stupidity, said no state would be more impacted by the diversion of funds to build the wall than California. For NPR News, I'm Peter John Schuller in San Francisco.
Police in Aurora, Illinois, say the gunman who killed five people at a manufacturing company yesterday was being fired from his job. Five police officers were wounded before the man was killed by police. Vice President Pence defending the Trump administration's global leadership at a security conference in Germany. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports.
The prestigious Munich Security Conference released a report arguing the Trump administration has displayed a, quote, irritating enthusiasm for strongmen around the world and contributed to a leadership vacuum in the, quote, liberal international order. Addressing delegates at the conference, Vice President Pence said at Trump's urging, NATO countries have boosted their defense spending. He said, that's what we call being leader of the free world. Pence repeated his call for Europe to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. Delegates received Pence's speech with muted applause, but gave German Chancellor Angela Merkel a sustained standing ovation. She defended the Iran nuclear deal and criticized the U.S. decision to withdraw troops from Syria. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Berlin.
This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Sharon Brody in Boston. The American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts is suing for information over a contract that President Trump said he awarded to build part of a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. The ACLU says it filed a public information request last year when the president tweeted about the contract. In the lawsuit filed yesterday, the group says it has not received any materials. Bicycling advocates are calling for more safety measures in Boston following another fatal crash. Yesterday at Brookline Ave and Park Drive in the Fenway area, a cement truck struck and killed 69-year-old Paula Shiraga of Cambridge. WBUR's Jerome Campbell reports.
People at the intersection were not surprised to hear about the fatal crash. Zachary Yonzon passes it almost every day on his way to his college classes. But he said you'll never catch him near the area on his bike.
There's always almost an instance where somebody crashes because people are changing into lanes here. And I think that it's just a bad design of the roads here.
Boston Cyclists Union is backing legislation on Beacon Hill to reduce fatal bike collisions. The bill calls for trucks to have more mirrors and large flaps that prevent cyclists from being caught under the truck's tires. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jerome Campbell.
More recreational marijuana stores may be coming to Worcester. The city is negotiating host agreements with four potential new retail stores. The new proposals increase the total number of proposed pot shops to 13. State law requires Worcester to allow for 15 stores. Sunshine today in Boston with a high around 40 degrees. This is 90.9 WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by DCU, Digital Federal Credit Union, where you can get low rates on car loans, mortgages, credit cards, and more. What can DCU save you? DCU.org. Lexus Broadway in Boston, welcoming the Tony-winning Les Miserables with new staging and scenery, opening at the Opera House April 16th. LexusBroadwayInBoston.com. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working alongside others to build a culture of health that provides everyone in America a fair and just opportunity for health and well-being. More at rwjf.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Here is how President Trump explains why he's decided to declare a national emergency on the border with Mexico.
It's very simple. We want to stop drugs from coming into our country. We want to stop criminals and gangs from coming into our country. Nobody's done the job that we've ever done. I mean, nobody's done the job that we've done on the border.
That's from the Rose Garden yesterday. Let's turn now to somebody who used to oversee that border. Gil Krulikowski was the Commissioner of U.S. Customs and Border Protection during the Obama administration. Before that, he was Director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. He was once the Chief of Police of Seattle. He joins us on the line now. Thanks very much for being with us.
Of course.
Mr. Krulikowski, do you think there's an emergency, criminals and gangs coming in at the southern border?
No, I don't. There's only a manufactured crisis by this president. When it was 1.6 million people coming across the border in 2000, that was a serious issue. Now it is well less than 400,000, and we have far more troops, people, and technology on the border than ever before.
As former Director of National Drug Control Policy, what do you think would be the best use of resources to stop drugs? I'll mention specifically, let's say, heroin, from entering the United States.
So first of all, the new STOP Act, which is a law that requires the United States Postal Service to step up their game, because we see a lot of heroin and fentanyl that come in through the Postal Service through the international mail. That's important. The other is to have better detection capabilities and, frankly, more people, not so much between the ports of entry, but at our ports of entry, which is where people come in, whether it's JFK or San Ysidro in California.
I notice you don't mention a wall.
I don't mention a wall. The marijuana comes between the ports of entry, but marijuana seizures have been down for many years, probably 8 or 9 years. You know, we have 10 states that made a decision to legalize marijuana. We have a lot of marijuana that's grown in the United States. So the marijuana issues, which I saw the president standing in front of bales of marijuana, those aren't the things, you know, that isn't killing people in this country.
I remember when you helped oversee drug policy. What worries you more, something like heroin or abuse of legal prescription drugs?
Well, we've seen a decrease in the last few years on opioids, the pills, and I think that was President Obama made that a signature effort early on in his administration. It was something that was really relatively unknown. But we've seen great cooperation from law enforcement and from health and others about the education and the reduction. This appetite for heroin, and particularly heroin that has been laced with fentanyl, is incredibly dangerous. Prevention, of course, would be a key.
In the minute we have left, as you noted, migration to the U.S. over the southern border is lower than it was 10 or 20 years ago, but the number of families arriving is up. Arizona, it's doubled over the last year. What should be done?
Well, we wanted to see an increase in immigration judges, and I applaud the administration for doing that, because you shouldn't wait 3 to 5 years to get your hearing. It should be expedited. A decision is made. And remember, most people that apply for asylum actually do not meet the threshold to enter the United States and stay in the United States.
Gil Kerlikowske, former Commissioner of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Nigeria's president has appealed for calm after the last-minute postponement of today's highly anticipated elections. The head of the Electoral Commission, Mahmoud Yakubu, made the late-night announcement just 5 hours before voting was set to start, explaining a one-week delay. NPR's Ophebia Quist-Arkton is in the capital, Abuja, joins us now. Ophebia, thanks so much for being with us.
Greetings.
And why the delay?
Well, the Electoral Commissioner says it was because of logistical problems. Voting materials have apparently not been delivered to all the remote parts of Nigeria, and there have been a series of fires destroying smart card readers and voting cards. Now, Mahmoud Yakubu says it was simply not feasible to proceed with these key elections today, and that the delay will ensure that the Electoral Commission and Nigeria hold free, fair, and credible elections. But those explanations are not going to wash, because why just 5 hours before the polling stations were meant to open? Surely, many people are saying, this should have been known weeks ago, or at least at the beginning of the week.
What about the reaction from candidates?
First of all, let me tell you that Nigeria's president, who had gone all the way to the north, to Katsina State, where his hometown is, Daura, has appealed to his compatriots to remain peaceful, patriotic, and united after the 11th hour announcement. But as a candidate, because, of course, President Muhammadu Buhari is seeking re-election, his party, the two main parties, Buhari's All Progressives Party and his main challenger, Atiku Abubakar's People's Democratic Party, have criticized the Independent National Electoral Commission, and they're also blaming each other. Buhari's APC says Atiku's PDP has undermined the Electoral Commission. Atiku's camp suggests that this delay is to help Buhari's chances of re-election. But the parties of both frontrunners have appealed for calm and are asking their supporters to be patient, because, of course, there is always the threat of violence if elections are delayed, yeah, or if there's any sort of trouble with Nigeria's elections.
What kind of reaction have you been able to get from voters in Nigeria?
Absolute fury. Nigerians are angry, they're frustrated, they're disappointed that they can't vote. Some simply can't believe this is happening. And the reaction on social media, Scott, has been brutal. Critical of the election organizers, saying they must have known that they weren't ready. Now, and also, let's add, many voters have had to travel to their hometowns and villages all over the country. Nigeria is Africa's most populous nation. 84 million people registered to vote. Some have traveled hundreds of miles from where they work and live, which is, of course, costing them time and money, and now they can't vote. They're not happy. And many are suspicious of the reasons for this postponement.
Mr. Yakubu, the election chief, says the vote will go ahead a week from today, Saturday, February 23rd. Do you see that happening?
He and his commission had better get it organized. Otherwise, the fury Nigerians are feeling today could spill into much worse. So they say the presidential vote. And of course, it wasn't just voting for president, also for governors, also for National Assembly, also for the State Assembly. So we'll have the presidential next Saturday and another vote. But some other votes have been postponed till 9th of March. That's after the original second round vote date of the 2nd of March. So the Electoral Commission has got to get itself sorted out.
NPR's Ophebia Quist-Arkton, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
We probably should not project human traits onto machines. But if you spend a lot of time with the mechanism, talk to it, wait to hear from it, and worry about it, even scientists begin to see personality in machinery. When the Opportunity Mars exploration rover ended its mission this week after more than 5,000 Martian days, NASA scientists mourned. "This is a hard day," Opportunity's project manager, John Callis, told reporters. "Even though it's a machine and we're saying goodbye, it's still very hard and very poignant." Opportunity and its cousin rover, Spirit, both landed on Mars in January of 2004. They were supposed to carry on for just 3 months, scratching and scouring for less than a mile over the Martian landscape. But Spirit roamed for almost 5 miles and lasted 6 years. Oppie, as scientists began to call the Opportunity rover, rolled over Mars for 28 miles and stayed on the job for more than 14 years. It transmitted 217,594,000 images, including a selfie. Spirit and Opportunity helped establish that there was once liquid water on Mars. This doesn't mean there will soon be beach resorts on Mars, but it does confirm that some of the elements of life may have once existed there on a world that now looks pretty dry, lifeless, and cold. It's a reminder not to judge too much by appearance. Planets and people have histories. Oppie got stuck in a dune in 2005, but NASA scientists working over a distance of millions of miles freed their rover. Oppie kept on rolling, searching, digging, sending back information. A dust storm enveloped much of Mars last June. Oppie foundered in a gully on the western rim of the Endeavour crater, in a gully the scientists called Perseverance Valley. The storm robbed Oppie of the solar power to recharge its batteries. NASA scientists sent it more than 830 rescue commands. They beamed music to Oppie to try to awaken their Martian explorer. David Bowie's Life on Mars, Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive, Here Comes the Sun by, you know. Oppie was too depleted to reply. The rover did send a last image of a dark world cloaked in dust. Jacob Margolis, a science reporter for KPCC in Pasadena, made a poetic translation of the digital bursts, bites, and squeaks Oppie sent out before going silent. "My battery is low, and it's getting dark. You might all hope for such a gentle end to a useful life." Take a look at the low man, beating up the wrong guy. Oh, man, wonder if you'll ever know who's in the best-selling show. Is there life on Mars? Ziggy Stardust, and you're listening to NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. It is 36 degrees in Boston at 8:18. Coming up on Weekend Edition Saturday, the future of the combustion engine and Science Magazine's Dance Your PhD contest, that and much more ahead on Weekend Edition. Experience WBUR's podcast Endless Thread live at the grand opening of WBUR City Space. That's February 28th, and the whole event is free. For more information, go to wbur.org/cityspace.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Merrimack Repertory Theater, with the premiere of Lauren Gunderson's The Heath, An Ode to a Grandfather by Way of King Lear, Sunday, March 10th, mrt.org. In the Museum of Science, the exhibit Nature's Superheroes, Life at the Limits, reveals the superpowers some species have developed to survive. Open now, mos.org.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. Former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick has been expelled from the priesthood. The Vatican announced a move to defrock McCarrick today. He is accused of abusing minors and seminarians. The ruling comes just 2 days before a global summit at the Vatican on clerical sex abuse. Nigeria's top two political parties are condemning the delay in the country's presidential election. It had been scheduled for today, but Nigeria's Election Commission has postponed it by a week, citing unspecified challenges. Electoral officials are expected to give more details today. And police in suburban Chicago say the gunman in Friday's workplace shooting was being fired from his job at a manufacturing company. Five co-workers were killed. Five police were wounded before the gunman was fatally shot. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, committed to reimagining banking, offering savings and checking accounts that can be opened from anywhere. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Capital One NA. From Babbel, a European-made language learning program. Babbel teaches practical conversation in Italian, Russian, Swedish, and other languages. Available in the App Store or online at babbel.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. President Trump's declaration of a national emergency along the southern border has been criticized by congressional Democrats. But some Republicans, conservative activists and thinkers are also voicing concerns. James Wallner is with the R Street Institute, a pro-free market conservative research group, and joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Do you have reservations or objections?
I think what we've seen over the past couple of days is really the epitome of dysfunction in our government at present. So I say yes, I have a lot of objections to what we're seeing.
Constitutional?
I think across the board, this is emblematic of the broader problem that we face, which is Congress not doing its job and pushing off issues that the American people want to adjudicate to the president, who then uses dubious authorities to do things that he couldn't otherwise do. It's about the very basis, the very nature of our regime.
What effect do you think this declaration of national emergency might have on that?
I think it makes everybody just a little more cynical, right? Here we have a situation where Congress has been facing this issue for months. We had the longest shutdown in American history, and they chose not to do anything about it. So far as I can tell, people who opposed the wall didn't try to win that debate. People who supported the wall didn't try to win that debate. The president didn't seem to be overly interested in trying to win that debate. And then we have a Congress who just passed a bill knowing full well that this was the most likely outcome, and they chose not to even try to stop it. But now that the bill has passed, the shutdown has been prevented, the government has been funded, the president can come out and say he's going to do this now, and you have people saying that we're shredding the Constitution, that this is the end of the world, that we need to act, that we need to stop something. Well, the time to act was before you pass a bill to give the president money to fund the government. The time to act, if you want to force a vote on this, if you want to force Republicans in the Senate to go on record, if you're a House Democrat, for instance, then you put language in the bill saying the president can't use national emergency powers to build a wall.
You mean senators, well, we could list their names, Susan Collins.
Right. I mean, don't vote for a bill that is going to make something that you think is really damaging to our country, to the republic, more likely to occur. Just don't do it, number one. Number two, actually go out and try to put things in the bill to prevent the thing that you think is so damaging to our republic from happening.
You know the answer to that. They want to win re-election, and they're particularly concerned about primaries.
I think we overstate this, right? I really do. I think we overstate the threat that primaries pose, number one, to members. Number two, what I would suggest is, okay, so what? That's your job. Comes with the territory, right? And last time I checked, the Constitution wasn't written so that members could win re-election without threat, right? That's not the point. The whole point, the whole basis of our regime of democratic accountability is so that members are held accountable for the decisions they make in office, not to push those decisions off elsewhere so that they can just keep winning. The only place where our views and our concerns are adjudicated in this wonderful nation of ours is in Congress. It's the only place. And if Congress isn't doing that, then Congress isn't doing its job.
See, you seem less concerned that the president is overreaching than that the Congress is sitting on its hands.
I think that is the much bigger concern. The president most certainly, it appears, to be overreaching, right? I mean, this law has been passed presumably not to do end runs around Congress when the president can't get what he or she wants. So if you want funding, it seems to me the best way to get it is to actually bargain and haggle and try to and refuse to sign bills that don't give you that funding. That's the way the Constitution envisions the process working. Not to say it doesn't matter. I'll just get it anyway when you fund the bill, when you send me that funding bill. And then the president's going to presumably not act. And he's going to lay down the shovels and he's going to turn off the tractors at the border when the courts come along and probably issue an injunction. And so now we've even further undermined the Constitution. And then all of a sudden, everybody gets upset. And then we scratch our heads and we look around and we wonder why things are so heated when Supreme Court justices like Brett Kavanaugh are up for confirmation. Well, the political branches are pushing everything towards the courts. And that appears to me to be the trajectory we're on with this wall.
James Wellner, senior fellow with the R Street Institute, former vice president for research at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
The Trump administration announced a controversial policy in December for migrants seeking asylum at the U.S. southern border. They would be returned to and remain in Mexico while their asylum cases are considered. The policy is in effect at a major border crossing in San Diego. The Southern Poverty Law Center and other groups are suing the administration, calling the policy, known as the Migration Protection Protocols, quote, a war on asylum seekers and our system of laws. Melissa Crowe is with the Southern Poverty Law Center. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
You contend this policy violates both U.S. and international law. How so?
So first of all, Scott, the government is basing this policy on a provision of the Immigration and Nationality Act that was never intended to apply to the group of asylum seekers who present themselves at ports of entry along the southern border. We allege that this new policy violates both U.S. and international legal principles that provide that individuals must not be returned to countries where they risk persecution or torture.
Ms. Crowe, you and other groups represent 11 asylum seekers who've already been returned to Mexico, and you believe that Mexico is a country in which they're at risk.
Yes. Even the U.S. State Department has indicated in its country reports on human rights that there is deep-seated animus in Mexico toward migrants. Other of the plaintiffs have fled gang violence in their countries of origin, and gangs don't observe state boundaries. And these people are terrified that they're going to be killed.
President Trump and others in the administration say that there are large numbers of people who use the asylum law to enter the U.S. and then just disappear. Do you agree?
We strongly disagree, and we think his figures are inaccurate. I would urge him to spend some time down on the border and hear some of the harrowing stories about the situation that these individuals have fled. I would also note that they are trying to enter the country legally, have entered the country legally, because they were inspected and processed at ports of entry. And he's been saying for a long time that that's what people should do. So it's kind of like a slap in the face when they try to do that and they get sent back.
The Department of Homeland Security, though, says that because they can't detain families for more than a few weeks, that's not enough time for the asylum claim to be processed. So they have to come up with something else.
I don't actually see a need to detain people at all. There are lots of alternatives to detention that have been shown to work. In many cases, people are released on ankle monitors so that the government can keep track of where they are. But once again, I don't think that the government's figures on appearance rates at hearings are accurate.
Mexico has expanded some of the rights of asylum seekers, non-Mexican asylum seekers, haven't they, in recent weeks? Humanitarian visas, work permits, access to legal services. Does any of that help?
I know that they have started giving humanitarian visas to individuals who are returned. They are supposed to provide for work authorization, but I understand that a number of our plaintiffs have had trouble finding jobs and also trouble proving that they are entitled to work in Mexico. And I think that goes back to the animus against migrants that I spoke of before.
Do you and other groups have an idea how many people we might potentially be talking about who are asylum seekers in Mexico?
We don't have an exact number. The government has said that they're going to expand this policy to Texas in the not too distant future. And my understanding is that as of Thursday, 8 families were returned. 8 families comprised of 13 adults and 13 children. And that was just one day.
Melissa Crowe of the Southern Poverty Law Center, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
The Democrats' proposed Green New Deal calls for America to eliminate greenhouse gas emissions from U.S. transportation an ambitious goal that would require, among many other things, phasing out cars that run on gasoline. That may sound like a major shift, but many analysts say that transition is already underway. NPR's Camila Domonoske reports.
If you're driving a car in America, odds are it runs on gasoline, which means it has an internal combustion engine. You put in fuel, tons of tiny explosions move some pistons, turn a crankshaft, the car starts moving, and carbon dioxide is released into the atmosphere. But your next car might run off batteries instead. Sam Abul-Samad is an auto analyst with Navigant.
Probably in the mid-2020s timeframe, it becomes comparable or cheaper to actually buy and operate an EV than an internal combustion vehicle.
Some analysts say the rise of EVs or electric vehicles could take decades instead. After all, right now, electric vehicles are a tiny percentage of cars. But many new electric vehicles are about to come to market. And analysts and auto executives agree a change is happening. It's not just activists talking. The internal combustion engine has some advantages, like fueling up.
5 minutes, bang, you're back on your way.
Bill Visnick is with the Society of Automotive Engineers.
Right now, we don't have that ability to replicate that with electric vehicles.
Plus, right now, electric cars are more expensive up front. But electric vehicles are cheaper to operate. They're very low maintenance, and those upfront costs are projected to go down. Government regulations are giving electric vehicles a boost, too, especially in Europe and China.
And they are fun to drive.
That's Tom Murphy, a managing editor at Ward's Auto, which ranks the world's best engines.
They're enjoyable, they're quiet, and there's loads of torque.
Instant acceleration. In short, the electric vehicle market is revving up dramatically. Even people who love the internal combustion engine see the writing on the wall. Like John Woods, who owns a 72 Porsche. He says this is the sound of the past.
It's the beginning of automotive, you know, engineering. But the electric car will be the future because you can get more power, more speed, and use no emissions.
Say that is the future. What happens to all the internal combustion engines already on the road? One possibility, they might get replaced quite quickly with electric vehicles. That's what environmental activists want for the sake of climate change. And Dan Neal, the automotive columnist for the Wall Street Journal, argues people might choose to switch to electric vehicles, even if their old car runs perfectly fine.
They're such better machines than the machines they're replacing.
High gas prices would speed that up, and some European cities have proposed bans on internal combustion vehicles, which would also accelerate change, but could be hard on low-income drivers. That's the fast option. Then there's the slow timeline. Abul-Samad, the auto analyst.
You know, if every new vehicle sold were electric, you know, starting today, it would still take 20 to 25 years to replace the entire vehicle fleet with electric vehicles.
If gas-powered vehicles stay on the road for their full lifespans, the transition would take much longer than the 10 years the Green New Deal calls for. Is that a problem?
We can't turn them all into planters or sculptures, so I think we're going to have to provide for them to continue to exist.
Mary Nichols is the head of the California Air Resources Board. She's a powerful regulator who has influenced the rise of electric vehicles. She emphasizes modern cars are cleaner than they used to be. She's been fighting air pollution since 1971.
In that time, the air emissions from internal combustion engines have been slashed by over 90% twice.
They're more efficient, too, which helps with climate change. And there's one last possibility. Maybe the combustion engine has a very long life ahead of it in the hybrids that run off electricity or fossil fuels. Then pistons and crankshafts might exist well into an electric-dominated future. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Tomorrow morning on Weekend Edition Sunday, we stay on the transportation beat with a far and away Q&A.
Maybe I'll do the rest of the interview upside down just for the kids in the classroom.
Lulu, some kindergartners, and an astronaut on the International Space Station on Weekend Edition Sunday tomorrow morning. You can ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Time now for Talking Birds.
The Bird Show. I like that. I love birds.
Ray Brown's Talking Birds.
Ray Brown, who's the host of the radio show and podcast Talking Birds, joins us now. Ray, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
I understand, my friend. We are in the middle of something called the Great Backyard Bird Count. Now, apartment dweller, I don't even have a backyard. How can I help?
You don't have to have a backyard, or not even a great backyard, or any kind. It could be the great wherever you happen to be. Looking out your office window, you can be looking out your kitchen window, you can be in a park, you can be just about anywhere in the world and just count the birds that you see and do your best to figure out what they are and then report them. There's a website, birdcount.org, and you only have to do it for a total of 15 minutes.
Birds are feathered things, right? Okay, I know
that's
that.
Right.
But I'm a little
yes.
foggy. I can identify cardinals and blue jays and orioles because they're attached to baseball teams. Other than that, I'm at a loss.
Well, one good thing is Cornell Lab has this thing called the Merlin Bird ID app, and it's free. You can download it to your iPhone or your Android phone. It gives you some great help on identifying birds. You can even now take pictures of birds, and it will help you identify that from the picture that you take. So it's a lot easier than it used to be. And of course, there are many field guides out there that will give you lots of help.
Well, what will this do, the Great Backyard Bird Count, to help birds and the people who love them?
Well, researchers will get all this data from people. You know, the researchers figured out some years ago that they couldn't collect enough data by themselves. So now they have hundreds of thousands of people collecting it for them. So it's a citizen science thing, and they get all of this data and they interpret it. They can figure out then how we can help birds survive, where they're going, how they're doing. And, you know, birds are a great indicator of the health of the ecosystems on our planet. So that's ultimately one of the great uses for the data that they collect.
And do you have any understanding of how the changing climate conditions might affect the count or where birds are?
Well, that's certainly one of the things that they are looking at. You know, there has been a phenomenon over the past, 30 or 40 years, I guess, where many bird species, songbirds in particular, have been expanding their ranges northward. And there's certainly a lot of indication that climate change has something to do with that. Increased bird feeding also has something to do with it, but certainly the temperature changes and the other changes associated with climate change seem to have a big impact on that. That's something, of course, that is being studied on an ongoing basis.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to be counting, Ray?
I will be counting on Sunday, as a matter of fact. The count goes through Monday, the 18th. And one of the cool things now is, thanks to eBird, this is the new online database, you can actually see the sightings of people all over the world coming in real time. It's almost like a video game. It's kind of the closest that I will get to a video game anyway.
Hmm. So what happens if all I see are pigeons?
Well, then just report pigeons.
Oh, okay.
Which are now called rock doves, by the way. They changed that name to rock pigeon a few years ago. Now it's changed back to rock doves.
Well, the pigeons didn't like being called pigeons?
They like doves better. Wouldn't you be rather called a dove than a pigeon?
If I I'll specify that to people the next time they call me a pigeon. Ray Brown, the host of Talking Birds, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. See you in the backyard.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Sharon Brody. The American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts has filed a lawsuit calling for records about a purported contract to build part of the border wall proposed by President Trump. On Twitter this past December, Trump made a claim about the contract, and the ACLU of Massachusetts submitted a public records request to the Department of Homeland Security seeking the contract and related documents. The organization says it has not received any of the requested materials. A study gets underway next week into options for protecting the public from sharks in the waters off Cape Cod. That follows a fatal shark attack at Newcomb Hollow Beach in Wellfleet this past September. More recreational marijuana stores may be coming to Worcester. The city's negotiating host agreements with four potential new retail stores. That brings the total number of proposed pot shops in the city to 13. This is WBUR.
WBUR supporters include Boston Interior's Winter Home Event, going on now. Furniture for every room, plus professional design advice at all stores. BostonInteriors.com. The ICA. Final weeks to see the William Forsythe Exhibition, interactive art that invites you to move, participate, and dance. Closes February 21st. ICABoston.org. And Boston University Wheelock College of Education and Human Development, online master's programs in higher ed administration. BU.edu/Wheelock.
This week, President Trump negotiated a new border security deal, which gives him less than what the Democrats offered him before he shut the government down. It's amazing that the buildings he used to put up didn't end up as giant holes in the ground. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us as we talk everything down. Plus, Matt Smith, former Doctor Who and Prince Philip from The Crown, talks about which fan base is crazier. It's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Today at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. on 90.9 WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Babbel, an interactive language program that teaches travel, business, and casual conversation skills in a new language, like Spanish. Available in the App Store or online at Babbel, BABBEL.com. And from the Alliance for Lifetime Income, a nonprofit composed of financial services organizations working to educate Americans about options for securing protected lifetime income in retirement. More at AllianceForLifetimeIncome.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. If the United States and China fail to reach an agreement on trade this month, tariffs may soon reach directly into consumers' pockets. Farmers and manufacturers have been affected for months. This latest round of talks puts more at stake for more people. Grant Gerlach of NET News in Nebraska reports.
In September, the Trump administration launched its biggest round of tariffs yet, a 10% tax on thousands of Chinese products, including a lot of everyday stuff. At this dollar store, I found a pair of pliers, some wall screws, eyeliner, a bath mat, all on the tariff list. But that doesn't mean the price on the tag is 10% higher.
I can't stress to you how much companies care about maintaining that stability.
That's Uche Jarrett, who teaches international economics at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
It drives their profit margins, it drives their estimates for the future. Whenever there is a change, there's a lot of uncertainty that follows.
Jarrett says so far, suppliers and retailers are shielding consumers from price hikes. They'd rather ding profits than lose customers. But soon, consumers might have to pay up. The administration's tariffs are aimed at narrowing the trade deficit with China. If there's no deal by March 1st, that 10% tariff will jump to 25%. Irv Blumkin is CEO of the home furnishings chain Nebraska Furniture Mart. He says a 25% tariff would lead to higher prices at his store for everything from carpet to patio furniture.
At 10%, you can come to a very minimal change. At 25%, it becomes a different deal.
Blumkin is concerned a higher tariff will scare away his shoppers.
You know, they hear the news every day and they see some of the uncertainties that are going on, and I think that impacts how people think.
Irv Blumkin says some manufacturers are moving their production to countries like Vietnam, Malaysia, or Mexico. While importers are scrambling, you might think that American manufacturers are benefiting from the tariffs, but maybe not. Take Bison, a company in Lincoln, Nebraska that makes sports hardware. I met CEO Nick Cusick at a local YMCA where some office workers were playing a round of pickup basketball. The rims, the backboards, and the wall pads were all made by Bison. Almost all the parts and pieces were manufactured in the U.S. too.
Since we do compete against a fair number of companies who buy offshore, you would think, generally speaking, that we would benefit from...
Yeah, aren't you supposed to be the winners in this thing?
We're supposed to be the winners.
But Cusick says there's a problem. When the U.S. raised taxes on imported steel, the price for American steel skyrocketed by as much as 50%. Bison had to raise its prices this year to cover costs.
But the end users, the schools, the consumers on our residential basketball side of our business, they're the ones that are getting hit. So it's kind of counterproductive.
Unless the U.S. reaches a deal with China in the next few weeks, more businesses will be raising prices. And that's when more consumers will begin to realize that trade wars come with a cost that they'll be feeling in their wallets. For NPR News, I'm Grant Gerlach.
That story comes to us from Harvest Public Media, a reporting collaboration that focuses on agriculture and rural issues. Bubba Wallace made history last year at the Daytona 500. He finished second. He became the first African-American stock car driver since 1971 to compete in that most famous stop on the stock car circuit. And by the way, he drove a Chevy Camaro for Richard Petty Motorsport, number 43, like the founder. The 500 opens the season tomorrow. Bubba Wallace, second season on the circuit. And Darrell, Bubba Wallace joins us now from Daytona International Speedway. Thanks so much for being with us, Mr. Wallace.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be on here with you.
What's this last year been like for you?
It's definitely been the toughest year I've ever had in my career. It's not just taking that next step. You have to be on top of your game from point A to point Z and back again. So it's been fun learning the ins and outs of the sport and you know, who you can work with, who you can't, and it's just all part of the game.
Yeah. Let me ask you a little bit about your background. You grew up in Charlotte, I gather, right?
Yes, sir.
And one of the homes of motor racing, obviously. How did you begin to race?
I started racing when I was 9 years old. My dad bought a Harley Davidson, got it all chromed out, took it to a bike shop. The guy who owned that bike shop raced go-karts, and he invited us to come out one weekend and come watch him. So it was simple as going out and watching and getting hooked and buying a go-kart and went out racing the next weekend and never turned back.
What do you think hooked you?
I think, you know, we got to travel a lot. That was fun. And you just got to do something where we thought we were pretty decent at. And we kept trying to be better and better in each series. We'd spend about 2 years in every series and move up to the next bigger and better and faster car. Next thing you know, you're driving the famed number 43.
And the name Bubba, how did that get into your life?
Yeah, Bubba came about, I think, the day I was born from my sister, Brittany. She called me that ever since I came out, and it kind of stuck, and now we've kind of created a brand around it.
As I don't have to tell you, some places in the South, and not just the South, the number 43 and the name Richard Petty are pretty much interchangeable.
Yes.
What is it like to drive the car that bears his name and number for the man himself?
Oh, it's awesome. You know, to hear the stories and the history behind the 43, him and Dale Inman at the track, I wouldn't trade it for anything. Honestly, it's fun trying to bring the legacy back and build the program back up to what it once was. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, but we all know how much it takes to be successful in the sport, and we're trying to do everything under our power to do that. So I've learned a lot, you know, in the last year I've been around them, but I've still got to dig deep and press hard on for this year.
He must really believe in you.
He does. He gave me the opportunity back when their former driver got hurt. And I was able to fill in for them. And then next thing you know, I get a phone call to come drive full time.
And, how's the sport changing?
It's changing every day. You know, I'm trying to do my best of filling out the demographic side of things and getting more faces in the stands and in the sport, whether that's behind the scenes or on pit crews or even in the seats to drive. So it's been a fun journey. It's been cool to see how things have changed over the years.
Bubba Wallace about to drive in his second Daytona 500. Good luck to you, sir. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
What is art? Well, the answer may be in Rhode Island's tax code. The state offers a sales tax exemption to resident writers, composers, and artists who sell what they call original and creative works of art there. What is original and creative? Paul Carancy is an author and Rhode Island resident. He joins us now from Providence in the studios of the Publix Radio. They used to call themselves Rhode Island Public Radio. Mr. Carancy, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Now, you've written a number of nonfiction books set in Rhode Island. I'll mention just one title, Monumental Providence. But I gather you don't qualify for this tax cut.
Well, it's a strange enforcement of the law. You have to complete a form, a tax exemption form, that you send into Division of Taxation with the titles of the book that you want to have exempted. And they will review that book and determine whether or not it qualifies for the exemption. And the general rule here is that if it's a work of fiction and poetry, it will qualify for tax exemption. If it is a work of nonfiction, then it will not.
A poet gets a break on the sales tax on his or her book, but not when they buy Cheerios.
That's correct. This was a bill that was intended by the Assembly to promote the arts, the local arts, by local artists. By the way, this is a definition that was developed by the Division of Taxation that said, we don't think an automotive manual, for example, should qualify for a tax break based on the fact that it's an automotive manual. It's not really an artistic work.
It is on a case-by-case basis, though, right? So in theory, the state commission could say, well, you know, the Executioner's Song by Norman Mailer is clearly a work of art, even though it's nonfiction.
They could say that. Our experience locally is that they have not. But even if they did, making something subject to taxation based on a very subjective interpretation is highly unusual, I would say, and it's grossly unfair.
You could have a writer like Joan Didion and or Truman Capote who have written both fiction and nonfiction. Some of their books, no sales tax. Some of their books, you'd have to pay sales tax.
Yeah. In Cold Blood, for example, by Truman Capote.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I read something to you?
Go ahead, please.
Okay. In 1775, John Adams was called to the Continental Congress by courier in the middle of a blizzard. That's history. But here's how David McCullough tells it in his award-winning nonfiction book, John Adams. In the cold, nearly colorless light of a New England winter, two men on horseback traveled the East Coast Road below Boston, heading north. Nothing about the harsh landscape differed from other winters, nor was there anything to distinguish the two riders. It might have been any year, and there could have been anybody, braving the weather for any number of reasons. Dressed as they were in heavy cloaks, their hats pulled low against the wind. Now that says the same thing. It defines the same event. But the way he said it, that's art. Mm. I don't care that it's history. That is art. You feel like you're right there in the middle of the storm, traveling with him.
When you say art, is that something that in the Midwest we'd call art?
Yes. I not only have a Rhode Island accent, I have a North Providence accent, which is even more difficult to understand. But thank you for pointing that out.
No, it's great to hear. It's great to hear. Paul Carranzi is also the author of Scoundrels, Defining Corruption Through Tales of Political Intrigue in Rhode Island. That sounds like an artful book. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks so much for having me on.
You know, sometimes a dissertation just isn't enough. A PhD has to get up and dance. This weekend at the American Association for the Advancement of Science convention, they have announced this year's winner of the Dance Your PhD contest, co-sponsored by Science Magazine. We will introduce you to the academic with the most dazzling footwork in a moment. But first, we're going to speak with John Bohannon. He launched the contest now in its 11th year. Mr. Bohannon, thanks so much for being with us.
Hello.
So what made you believe dance could illuminate science?
Well, I have to admit it all started with a somewhat drunken party.
Keep it scientific here, Mr. Bohannon, okay?
Well, all the partygoers were scientists, and I wanted to get them to dance, so I tapped into their competitive spirit.
And as a generalization, are scientists gifted dancers?
I think in general, they're exhibitionists. If you're willing to stand up and defend some crazy, obscure research topic that you've devoted your life to, then there's probably something in you that wants to dance.
Well, we don't want to delay anymore. We want to introduce the winning entry, a gentleman who authored a paper, I know you'll all go about your Saturday, humming this title, Impact of Non-Local Electrodynamics on Flux Noise and Inductance of Superconducting Wires. It has, however, been transformed into Superconductivity the Musical.
These electrons have a predilection, a shirt that soaks up all connections of non-interacting loaders they can't be.
Ah, come on. You just can't stay in bed any longer after listening to that, can you? This wondrous tableau of music and dancing electrons was created by Pramod Senarathyappa. Mr. Senarathyappa is now working on his PhD at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. He joins us from the studios of the CBC in that great city. Thanks so much for being with us, Mr. Senarathyappa.
great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Describe this video for us, if you can.
Yeah, so it is a look at the social lives of electrons in three acts. It starts off with electrons in a normal metal just being very unsociable as they are.
You mean like cold to each other, distant, not receptive, that sort of thing?
They just completely ignore each other and don't pay attention to any of their neighbors. Uh-huh. As the weather changes and it becomes a little chilly outside, as it is in Edmonton right now, they feel a need for companionship, and they pair up, essentially. Super, duper, cool pair, believe it, don't say, avec moi. And they're much happier that way, and they keep dancing throughout the wire. These electrons form something called Cooper pairs. And in the final act, I bring in some final punk impurities. Dustin impurities come marching. Which are just some unhappy little dirt particles that are in superconductors, and they really don't like it when Cooper pairs are near them, and they get very angry and make a lot of noise. Large size. By listening to this noise, you can figure out what the Cooper pairs are exactly doing, and that's the topic of my research.
Yeah. You wrote the music?
I did write the music. So I've been playing guitar and recording music for something like 13 years now, super into jazz. So yeah, I wrote all of the music and recorded it in my bedroom over the course of 6 weeks last year.
Mr. Bohannon, can we work in another question to you?
You bet.
I know you weren't a judge, but what do you think got to the judges about this routine?
This year was special because we had not only a great dance, Pramod really just had a wonderful, wonderful dance that did these two jobs that we're always trying to do at once with the contest. Not only explain science, but actually entertain you.
To be clear, though, Mr. Senarathiappa, you just can't do this as a dance, right? You have to also, like, come up with papers and that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I have actually published in an academic journal, so if you want to go read that, the paper should be out in Physical Review Applied soon. But this is also a nice way to think about what's going on at the subatomic level in these really esoteric physics concepts.
So you can download the scientific dissertation or... you can download the dance.
Yeah, or you can do both.
John Bohannon is with Science Magazine and is the founder of the contest. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Pramod Senarathiappa is the winner of this year's Dance Your PhD contest. May your life be filled with dance and good physics.
Thank you very much. Now they say,
this is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Ken and Lucy Lehman family, who appreciate that for three decades, NPR has helped them to better understand a complex nation and world through its in-depth coverage of events, ideas, and cultures. And from Cunard, sailing the transatlantic crossing between New York and London on the luxury ocean liner Queen Mary II, where guests can experience fine dining and entertainment. More from a travel advisor or at cunard.com/cross.
This is 90.9 WBUR and WBUR.org. It is 36 degrees in Boston at 9 o'clock as Weekend Edition continues. Sunny today, high around 40.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Jewish Arts Collaborative. Enjoy inspired Israeli cuisine at Beyond Bubby's Kitchen on Sunday, March 3rd. Tickets at jartsboston.org. And Tower Hill Botanic Garden, an indoor oasis to escape the bleak midwinter among lush conservatories brimming with subtropical plants and flowers, towerhillbg.org.
I'm Michelle Martin. Virginia Governor Ralph Northam is heading out on what he calls a reconciliation tour after blackface photos were discovered on his medical school yearbook page. But what does racial reconciliation actually look like? We're taking it to the barbershop. Join us for a conversation about bridging divides and healing communities next time on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 5 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR News station.
From Boston University, you're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston, home of Boston's largest radio newsroom, 92.7 WBUA Tisbury, 89.1 WBUH Brewster, and streaming at WBUR.org. WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. Six people have died, five police officers wounded at a factory shooting yesterday in Aurora, Illinois. The police chief told reporters,
"The response by our officers saved lives today. They took on gunfire, but they pressed on until they located the shooter."
We'll have the latest. Also, Pope Francis has defrocked Theodore McCarrick, the former cardinal and archbishop of Washington, D.C. We'll have a report from Rome. President Trump has declared a national emergency along the southern border. This hour, a Republican lawmaker who is skeptical, and later a settlement between Colin Kaepernick and the NFL, but an NDA keeps them silent. First, our newscast. It's Saturday, February 16, 2019.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Vice President Pence is defending the Trump administration's global leadership at the annual Munich Security Conference in Germany. He was among the speakers at today's session when he praised President Trump's leadership among NATO allies.
At President Trump's urging, in the past 2 years, the number of NATO members spending at least 2% of their GDP on defense has doubled.
Pence also repeated his call for Europe to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. He spoke after German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who received a standing ovation after she defended the deal and questioned U.S. strategy in Syria. U.S.-backed fighters in Syria appear about to capture the last pocket of territory held by Islamic State in the eastern part of the country. A commander with the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces says the remaining IS fighters besieged in a village near the Iraqi border and that he expects victory will be completed in a very short time. Yesterday, President Trump said the White House will make an announcement about Syria by the end of today. President Trump's decision to declare a national emergency along the southern border already receiving pushback. Legal challenges are being considered, and Democrats are promising a fight. Last night, the House Judiciary Committee announced it's launching an immediate investigation. In San Diego, people who cross the border on a regular basis have strong opinions about the president's declaration to get more border wall funding. Jean Guerrero, member station KBBS, has more.
The San Ysidro Port of Entry is the busiest land border crossing in the U.S. Tens of thousands of people cross every day to do business, to go to school, or to work. One of those is Alma Tamaura. She's 26, a dual citizen, and lives in Tijuana but works in retail in San Diego. She says Trump's emergency declaration worries her because the border crackdown is already changing how she feels every day crossing the border.
It's more militarized, a little bit more scary. It makes you worry, you never know what could happen.
Tamaura's concern, like many other cross-border residents here, is that further militarization could end up limiting her ability to have her binational life. For NPR News, I'm Jean Guerrero in San Diego.
The Inspector General for the Homeland Security Department has issued a report about conditions at a jail in New Jersey where 800 immigrants are held. From member station WNYC, Matt Katz reports.
During a surprise visit to the Essex County Jail, inspectors found visibly moldy bread being used in bread pudding and foul-smelling hamburgers so rotten they were unrecognizable. They also learned that a detainee who was cleaning a bathroom found a guard's loaded handgun and turned it in. The county has a contract worth about $34 million a year to hold people for Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Officials from the county and ICE said the problems are being rectified. For NPR News, I'm Matt Katz.
And you're listening to NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Sharon Brody in Boston. The state Civil Service Commission says Brookline was not justified in firing a black firefighter who alleged racial discrimination. Gerald Alston was terminated in 2016 after complaining of racism in the department. WBUR's Hanin Joran-Wimeka has more.
The commission says Brookline did not properly discipline a superior officer who left Gerald Alston a voicemail using a racial slur. The commission also says the town overlooked ongoing retaliation against Alston and actively promoted a false narrative that he was a paranoid employee. Alston says he now feels vindicated.
I was never crazy. They try to make it out to be like I was crazy. They try to make it out like I was being vindictive, and I was just doing this out of spite or for some odd reason. This proves otherwise.
The commission ordered that Alston be reinstated as a firefighter. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Zanin Jor in Wameka.
After a legal fight, an Ipswich man is getting his addiction treatment in jail. Jeffrey Pesci yesterday began serving a 60-day sentence for driving with a suspended license. A judge cleared the way for his methadone treatment over the opposition of the Essex County Sheriff. Some Massachusetts jails will begin offering addiction medications as part of a pilot program later this year. The new orange and red line cars on the MBTA may cost millions of dollars more than planned. That's because the U.S. Trade Representative will not lift the tariff on parts for the cars being imported from China. A T spokesperson tells the Boston Globe any increased costs will not be paid by T riders, but will be paid by the Chinese company that owns the Springfield factory where the cars are being built. In sports, last night in Anaheim, the Bruins beat the Ducks 3-0. Tonight, the Bees are in L.A. against the Kings. It's 36 degrees in Boston now. Sunny today, a high around 40. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by GEICO, protecting people and their vehicles for over 75 years. GEICO is proud to offer car insurance and more to Massachusetts drivers, too. Additional information at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO. That's 1-800-947-AUTO. And Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Much of the reaction to President Trump's declaration of a national emergency has, unsurprisingly in these times, been along partisan lines. Democrats are outraged. They want to investigate. Many Republican lawmakers are lining up behind Mr. Trump. Representative Don Bacon, a Republican of Nebraska, a former Brigadier General in the Air Force, sits on the House Homeland Security and Armed Services Committee. He joins us on the line from his home district in Nebraska. Thanks so much for being with us, Mr. Bacon.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
You have said in the past that there's a compelling case to be made for a border wall. The president says he has to declare a national emergency to build it. Do you agree?
Well, I agree that it needs more funding. I think the compromise that Schumer and Pelosi negotiated was very anemic. There should have been more money put towards the wall. But I don't agree that declaring a national emergency and getting funding that way is the right way to go. I mean, the Congress has the power of the purse. I believe in checks and balances in our system. And so I'm concerned, and not just for this president, but we've seen a series of presidents, when they can't get what they want out of Congress, do executive orders or national emergency, whatever it may be. And I just think it weakens our constitutional system and our republic. So this isn't a direct criticism just of Trump. I just think I've been seeing this the last decade or two. But secondly, declaring a national emergency takes money out of the military construction and other areas that also need to be funded.
$3.6 billion, apparently.
Right. Yeah. That's a significant amount. And so this will hurt military construction and some things that we need to be doing for our men and women defending our country. So I have concern on those two areas.
Congress can rescind a presidential emergency declaration by passing a joint resolution. Would you consider doing that?
I'll consider it. I haven't made up my mind yet because I do think there's a compelling case that we have a problem at our southern border. And I felt like the spending levels, the compromise should have been better. I was anticipating somewhere between $2 and $3 billion. And the C-1.37 billion, I think it was, that was in the compromise, or 55 miles of wall, I thought it was inadequate. I thought the compromise should have been somewhere more in the middle there. But having said that, I don't like working around our constitutional system and our checks and balances and the Congressional Article 1 power of the purse to do so.
Now, the kind of a joint resolution that some people are talking about would, in effect, be an up and down vote on the wall. Would that be a good thing for Congress and the American people?
You know, I have split feelings. We need to have more funding for the wall, but declaring a national emergency and taking it out of the military construction or working around Congress's Article 1 authorities, mm-hmm. I don't think that's right either. So this is going to be something I'm going to have to really meditate and think on and work through and be a good listener. I need to make sure I get both sides of this issue. I supported funding of the wall through the normal appropriations process, but declaring a national emergency, I just don't think it's healthy for our country and our constitutional system.
Does declaring a national emergency create, without being histrionic, what amounts to a constitutional emergency?
I wouldn't go that far because we do have many examples of national emergencies, but we do have a bad trend. We have a Congress that's unable to act right now on hard issues because of gridlock, partisanship, and so tough issues aren't being settled by Congress. And we're seeing presidents of both parties fill in this void with executive action or, you know, unilateral decision-making, or in some cases, the judicial branch legislating from the bench. Mm-hmm. And so I see an unhealthy trend. I think we have a constitutional problem. I wouldn't call it a crisis, but it's been building up, not just with this president, with President Obama, President Bush, and President Clinton before that. And so I want to go back to where Congress is an equal branch, one of three equal, you know, branches of our government. And right now you'll see a growing executive and judicial branch and a weakened legislative branch. And I don't think that's healthy. It's not what our founding fathers envisioned.
Congressman Don Bacon of Nebraska, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Going to turn now to NPR's Ron Elving. Ron, thank you for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
You heard the congressman wrestle with constitutional and congressional authority. Is there any chance that Congress will challenge this emergency declaration?
The House might do that. The House might well do that, but the Senate isn't likely to. If they wish to, they might have included more of a preventive measure against this in the funding deal that they just passed. And as the congressman just said, that funding deal was a compromise between the parties, between the House and Senate, and then between the Congress and the president. And the numbers were basically what Trump had agreed to in December, before he got so much heat in the conservative media space that he changed his mind and forced the shutdown that then lasted 5 weeks. So with nothing to show for all that and the wall still not funded, the president has chosen a different kind of grand gesture, an assertion of executive power. So now the courts must decide whether the Constitution allows the president to fund something Congress has refused to fund.
Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, of course, had said that he didn't think an emergency declaration was a great idea. When it was announced yesterday, he said he's behind it. Is it as simple as he looked at a few polls or listened to what you called the conservative media space?
There have been signs of Mitch McConnell pushing back in recent weeks. But look, the Senate Majority Leader is caught in a replay loop. He warns the president the votes aren't there for, say, total repeal of Obamacare. He warns the president about the wall. He warns the president about the shutdown and about the declaration of emergency. And each time, Trump ignores him, and each time, McConnell takes a knee. And he does it because he simply can't resist Trump's dominance in what is now the Republican Party. Much to his chagrin, McConnell has come to embody his party's rather supine relationship to this president.
President Trump said yesterday he expects the question of his emergency declaration to wind up at the Supreme Court. A question to be included or not on the 2020 census is already before the court, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Now, in the Rose Garden yesterday, Trump essentially said he expects to lose at every level in the courts until the case reaches the Supreme Court, where he hopes his own appointees can tip the balance. He hopes the same on the census question you mentioned. That's about adding a citizenship question that was abandoned 60-some years ago. That question was shown to be depressing participation in the census and thereby defeating the constitutional purpose of having a census in the first place.
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, back at work.
Yes, the legend continues. She was back on the job.
Her doc is up for the Academy Awards, too, just in time.
That's right, and there's another movie about her career as well. She's expected to also be back next week, and her presence on the court has never been more important.
Special counsel investigation, Sarah Sanders revealed she was interviewed. Paul Manafort, the president's former campaign chairman, has been found to repeatedly lie during his interviews.
And the sentencing recommendation is about 20 years. Remember, he's already sentenced to prison in a related case last year, but it's clear Manafort long ago gave up on defending himself in all this. At this point, he's sending signals that he is not cooperating with the government or the Mueller investigation and relying on his hopes for a pardon from the president.
NPR Senior Washington, D.C. editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Deer in the northeastern United States have been munching through forests, eating up bushes and small trees, no doubt looking for B.J. Lederman, who writes our theme music. The overpopulation of deer has changed the way that forests look. And as NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, the deer have also changed the way that forests sound.
Megan Gall is an ecologist at Vassar College. She studied how birds react to human-created noise from nearby cars or overhead planes. After talking with a couple of colleagues who study how deer can consume the entire understory of a forest, she started wondering how that might change the soundscape.
So if you think about going into a gymnasium, there's lots of really hard surfaces, and sound will bounce all around, and that'll change how it hits your ear. Compared to going outside after a fresh snow, it'll be very quiet. And the same thing happens in forests versus other kinds of habitats.
Her colleagues already had two experimental areas set up inside a forest. One area was fenced off. The other was marked off but left open so that deer could enter and gobble up plants. Gall's team set up audio equipment in each place to test how the different environments affected the transmission of some basic sounds.
All of these things are found in different kinds of animal sounds, and so we wanted to have sort of a very broad palette of sounds to look at. One was just pure tones. So pure tones are like single notes. We're also looking at white noise, which covers a large range of frequency. And then we had trills. So trills are things you'll hear in a lot of bird songs.
What they found is that sounds changed less when they traveled through areas grazed by deer.
When deer were browsing, we actually found that the sound was clearer. And that's probably because there was less vegetation in the way. And so you don't have as many sounds bouncing off of leaves and sticks and things like that.
The results are published in a journal called PLOS One, and they raise questions about how this is affecting birds as they sing songs to defend territories or find mates. Bernie Lohr is a bioacoustics researcher at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He says birds are known to change their songs in response to ambient noise near, say, airports. The deer's activity might have a similar effect.
Something like this should change the acoustic structure of the signals, especially learned signals, which evolve culturally, and so that can happen quite quickly.
He says forest birds might start using higher frequencies that are more typical of birds living in open habitats, like grassy fields. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
City Space is WBUR's new home for public conversation on Commonwealth Avenue at Boston University. See the lineup and get tickets at wbur.org/cityspace.
It is 36 degrees in Boston at 9:18. Ahead on Weekend Edition Saturday, you will consider the concept of the rent-a-goalie. Sunshine today in Boston, a high around 40, overnight low around 20 degrees. Tomorrow, increasing clouds and highs in the mid-30s. This is 90.9 WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston University, Wheelock College of Education and Human Development, online master's programs in administration and curriculum and teaching. BU.edu/Wheelock. The ICA, final weeks to see the William Forsythe exhibition, interactive art that invites you to move, participate, and dance, closes February 21st. ICABoston.org. And Camp Oatka on Sebago Lake, Maine, an overnight boys camp committed to service and character through outdoor activities and the arts. CampOatka.org.
Hi. I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. Vice President Pence is urging Europe to follow the U.S. out of the landmark Iran nuclear deal. Pence spoke today at the Munich Security Conference, saying Germany, France, and Britain are trying to break U.S. sanctions on Iran. Germany's chancellor defended the deal. U.S.-backed fighters in Syria appear about to capture the last pocket of territory held by Islamic State in the eastern part of the country. A commander with the Syrian Democratic Forces says that he expects a victory will be completed shortly. And voters in Nigeria will have to wait another week to choose their new president. The Electoral Commission postponed the election until next weekend. The announcement came just 5 hours before voting was to start today. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Noom, offering a personalized weight loss program that uses psychology and small goals to change habits with the goal of losing weight and keeping it off for good. Learn more at Noom, NOOM.com. From Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where physician researchers are working to create vaccines to enable a person's immune system to stop melanoma and other cancers. More at danafarber.org/defeatcancer. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Just 5 days before Pope Francis opens a global summit on clerical sex abuse, the Pope approved the dismissal from the priesthood of a once powerful American prelate, former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. McCarrick had been found guilty by the Vatican of sexual abuse of minors and adults. He is the highest profile Roman Catholic figure in modern times to have been defrocked. And Pier Silvia Pagioli joins us from Rome. Silvia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
And remind us again of the accusations against McCarrick.
Well, today the Vatican spokesman Alessandro Gisotti read out the ruling handed down by the Vatican's theological watchdog office. McCarrick, who is 88 years old, was found guilty of the following crimes:
solicitation in the sacrament of confessions, and sins against the sixth commandment with minors and with adults, with the aggravating factor of the abuse of power.
Now, the crime of solicitation takes place when a priest takes advantage of the sacrament of confession, when the penitent is at an emotionally vulnerable state, to commit an immoral act. And the sixth commandment in Catholic doctrine concerns sexual behavior and the vow of celibacy that all priests must take. The ruling, which is definitive, means that McCarrick can no longer consider himself a priest and he cannot celebrate the sacraments. And as you may remember that already last July, on the Pope's orders, McCarrick became the first Catholic prelate in nearly 100 years to lose the title of cardinal. His downfall has really been stunning.
There have been allegations about sexual misconduct around Cardinal McCarrick for a number of years, weren't there?
Absolutely. Rumors had been circulating and around McCarrick. He had risen to a position of power as Archbishop of Washington. Several priests and former priests came forward with allegations that he had used his authority to coerce seminarians studying for the priesthood to sleep with him. Then last summer, allegations emerged that he had abused a minor some 50 years ago. Another man who claimed he'd been abused as a boy said McCarrick, then a priest, had touched his genitals during confession. In any case, he will not be prosecuted in the U.S. because the statute of limitations on these crimes has run out.
The Pope's decision is historic. Was it unexpected?
Not at all. We've been expecting it for weeks. The McCarrick case, along with several other clerical sex abuse scandals that erupted around the world, dominated headlines for much of 2018. This had led Pope Francis to calling to Rome the presidents of all the world's bishops' conferences for a summit that starts next Thursday, and the Pope wanted to have the McCarrick case closed before that event started. Spokesman Gisotti today also repeated a statement he issued in October when the scandals were really at their peak.
Both abuse and its cover-up can no longer be tolerated, and the different treatment for bishops who have committed or covered up abuse in fact represents a form of clericalism that is no longer acceptable.
Now, you know, McCarrick was once one of the most powerful prelates in the Catholic Church. He was a globe-trotting power broker, one of the most successful fundraisers in the American Church. His downfall is now raising questions about the protection he enjoyed during the papacy of Pope John Paul II, who has since been proclaimed a saint. If you remember, the first clerical sex abuse scandals in the U.S. revealed by the Boston Globe in 2002 were pretty much dismissed here at the Vatican. John Paul himself, who grew up in a communist state, had seen Polish police use pedophilia accusations against priests as slander. Others here at the Vatican saw the American abuse scandal at best as solely American, at worst as part of an anti-Catholic media campaign. That's no longer the case here. I spoke to a church historian today who said the defrocking of McCarrick can be seen as the first sign of a reassessment of the John Paul papacy.
NPR Sylvia Poggioli in Rome. Thanks so much for being with us, Sylvia.
Thank you, Scott.
Six people are dead after a mass shooting at an industrial plant in a western suburb of Chicago. Five police officers were wounded in that violence yesterday. Police say the shooter was a 45-year-old man who had been let go from the company. Patrick Smith of member station WBEZ was in Aurora yesterday after the shooting and joins us now. Patrick, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What have we learned in the hours that have elapsed about the shooting itself, when it started, how long it went on, what the scene was like inside that factory?
Well, Aurora Police Chief Christian Zeman said that they got multiple calls a little before 1:30 p.m. yesterday from the manufacturing plant known as Henry Pratt about an active shooter. She said that police arrived there within 5 minutes. However, police right now believe that all of the people who were killed before police got there. Then police were fired upon as soon as they arrived at the manufacturing plant.
The male fired upon the officers as they arrived, striking two of the four first responders. The response by our officers saved lives today. They took on gunfire, but they pressed on until they located the shooter. Some are recovering from their physical wounds, and others are home safe, recovering from their emotional wounds.
And then even after that those first four officers were shot at, there was another round of officers that went in. They were shot at, too. And then there was about 90 minutes without any gunfire as they were trying to locate the shooter in this sort of massive facility. And then about 90 minutes later, he shot at police again, and he was killed in the exchange of gunfire.
Patrick, what have we learned about the people who died and the five, I must say, very brave officers who were wounded in the shooting?
Well, we still don't know the identity of the victims. As of this morning, authorities were still not releasing their names, saying they were still notifying the family. We do know that they were all male. They were all employees at this manufacturing plant. The five officers were also all male. They were all from the Aurora Police Department. We know that the chief described their injuries as not life-threatening. A couple of them had surgery yesterday, but she said none of them are in critical condition. It seems like they will be okay, at least as far as surviving their wounds.
And what's been learned about the shooter? I gather he was about to be let go.
Yeah, he was 45-year-old Gary Martin, who lived in Aurora. There's a little bit of confusion on the timeline. You know, police yesterday said that he was terminated on Friday. However, I spoke to Martin's sister, and she said that he, at the very least, knew he was going to be let go 2 weeks ago. She said he was very upset about it. She described him a few days before the shooting as very depressed at a family dinner. But we're still waiting to know more. We know he used a handgun, but we don't know if it was registered to him or where he got that gun.
And, of course, this occurs in a week when so much of the country has been observing and commemorating the people who died, young students, staff members in the shooting in Parkland, Florida, at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School exactly a year ago. And I wonder, as you went around Aurora and spoke with the people of that town, did the anniversary come up?
That did come up. You know, many people were just thinking about the immediate tragedy right there in their own hometown. But it did come up talking to people. There's actually a resident of Aurora named Greg Zanis who, long before this happened, he had gained some national renown for going out to mass shooting sites across the country and putting up crosses to memorialize the dead. When I spoke to him yesterday, he pretty quickly brought up the fact that we had just been mourning the people lost at Parkland.
It just seems like America doesn't get a break. But we never thought something like this would happen in our town. You know, this is our town. And we know now our streets are covered in blood.
So that was Aurora resident Greg Zanis.
Well, Patrick Smith of WBEZ in Chicago, thanks so much for being with us, Patrick.
Thanks for having me.
The national debt passed $22 trillion this week, the highest amount ever. And deficit hawks aren't really screeching. To talk about how we got here, what it might mean, is Bob Bryan. He's a senior policy reporter at Business Insider. Mr. Bryan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
President Trump campaigned on a pledge to not just reduce the national debt, but eliminate it. So how did we get to the biggest national debt ever?
There's a long history and there's a short history. The long of it is, for the last 30 years, we haven't been taxing as much as we've spent. That's the simple way to put it. If you're looking in the short term, a lot of it is we're spending a lot of money on an aging population. In just the last few years, we've seen the Republican tax reform laws actually slash taxes, which has brought down the revenue coming into the country, into the Treasury. And at the same time, Congress agreed to this two-year spending bill, which really raises the amount of money that we're spending on various programs.
Now, the whole logic, though, of cutting taxes, of course, was to increase public spending, and thereby that bank shot would increase tax revenues ultimately.
Yeah, that's the idea. We've definitely seen corporate tax revenues drop off. Last year, we saw corporate tax revenues, after their tax rate was cut, fell off a cliff significantly. We haven't seen that on the personal side yet, but the idea is that even if you cut taxes and lower revenue in the short run, that the economy grows so much faster that your revenue is going to overall in aggregate get higher. At the same time, you know, our spending has been going up, so it's unclear whether or not that's really happened.
Now, years ago, I covered the bankruptcy of a great American city. And I know one of the problems that they had to confront was paying the debt service. They had to pay that off before anybody else got paid.
Yeah, debt service is a significant portion of the amount of debt that we're paying. In fact, there are reports that the debt service that we pay is going to grow larger than some of these major programs like Medicaid and Social Security in coming years. As interest rates go up as well, it becomes more expensive to pay it down. So not only the debt that we've accumulated is going up, but also the amount that we are having to pay to pay off that debt also goes up.
Well, let me try and get hold of that statistic. You mean it's possible that because the deficit is so large, we might be paying more to service that debt than we're paying out to take care of people under Medicare or Social Security?
Yeah. So as interest rates rise too, it's going to get more expensive to pay it. So the amount we're going to have to put towards debt service is going to get significantly larger. At least projections say so.
Why do so few people no longer consider this a crisis?
Politically, I think a lot of it is because doing the things that would be necessary to handle the debt are unpopular. Cutting back Social Security, cutting back Medicare, it's tough to cut those because a lot of people depend on them, a lot of people like them. From an economist's perspective, there actually is a growing school of thought that the debt isn't as big of a deal as we've made it out to be. There's a growing economic theory called modern monetary theory that surmises that the number, this $22 trillion number, actually isn't the important part about the debt. It doesn't matter what the number really is. It's how it's affecting the economy. And so right now, we're still seeing a strong growth economy. The inflation is still low.
Do you see this deficit becoming politicized into an argument that entitlement programs like the ones you just mentioned should be slashed?
So for years, politicians, especially in the Republican Party, have been saying that to get the debt under control, we need to address the big long-term drivers of the debt. Those are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. But actually getting around to cutting those programs is pretty difficult because it is so politically unpopular.
Now, I noticed President Trump at his press conference on Friday seemed to think that there were billions to be saved by coming back home from foreign wars. Foreign deployments, which we should remind ourselves that used to be a Democratic principle.
Right. And that is very much kind of, as Democrats have been saying for a long time, why do we need to cut these programs that Americans rely on when we're spending so much money in Iraq, Afghanistan, that sort of thing? And I certainly think that those are a large driver, but they don't take up as big of a slice as a lot of the programs, the entitlement programs and the stuff that we do back home.
Bob Bryan, senior policy reporter at Business Insider, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Russia marked the 30th anniversary of the Soviet Army's withdrawal from Afghanistan yesterday. That 9-year war drained the Soviet Union and foreshadowed the collapse of its communist system just 2 years after the pullout. NPR's Lucian Kim reports on how Russian veterans remember the war.
Moscow's Afghan War Museum is located on the ground floor of an apartment building on the outskirts of the city. When I close the metal door behind me, Igor Yerin, the director, comes out to meet me. The museum is just a couple of halls filled with artifacts from the war that started with the Soviet invasion in 1979. He points to maps, photographs, medals, a pair of combat boots, a boombox, and a Kalashnikov assault rifle. Yerin worked in a Moscow car plant before he was drafted at age 20. In Afghanistan, he served 2 years as an infantry platoon sergeant.
First of all, we were following orders. And secondly, the motherland sent us. We wouldn't have gone on our own. We were young, but we understood that we were fighting for our country.
Yerin turns on his phone to show me a slideshow of black and white photos accompanied by a song about Kunduz, the Afghan city where he was based. Pagib, Yerin says, he died, as photos of fallen comrades flash by on the tiny screen. The war was fought against U.S.-backed fighters known as the Mujahideen. It cost the lives of 15,000 Soviet soldiers and hundreds of thousands of Afghan civilians, and for years was considered a fatal mistake by the Soviet leadership. At a neighborhood park known as Afghan Square, veterans gathered on Thursday to mark the 30th anniversary of the war's end. Veterans and members of the community marched holding portraits of young men who never came back. Marina Tishnikova said the war touched everyone, and that the photographs on display showed only a fraction of those from her district who were killed. Veterans laid flowers at the base of a stark war memorial depicting three grieving mothers with bowed heads. Then, on a snow-covered field nearby, a Russian Orthodox priest blessed the cornerstone of a new church dedicated to the veterans of the Afghan War, followed by a rifle salute. Back in his museum, Igor Yerin says he has no regrets. He feels proud of himself and the country he fought for, even if it doesn't exist anymore. Yerin says he and his comrades never considered themselves conquerors, and that the Soviets did more for Afghanistan in the 9 years they were there than the U.S. has done in a war that has lasted almost twice as long.
We trained teachers and doctors and soldiers. Of course, there was a political element to it, but we even sent an Afghan into space in 1988.
Like many veterans, Yerin is bitter about the role the United States played during the war, supplying the Mujahideen with weapons and money. Yerin says there wouldn't even have been a war without the American aid. Lucian Kim, NPR News, Moscow.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Sharon Brody in Boston. The State Civil Service Commission says Brookline was not justified in firing a black firefighter who alleged racial discrimination in the fire department. And the commission has ordered the town to reinstate Gerald Alston. The commission says Brookline did not properly discipline a superior officer who left Alston a voicemail using a racial slur. And the commission says the town overlooked retaliation against Alston and actively promoted a false narrative that he was a paranoid employee. The Massachusetts Senate president has assigned a different senator to lead the Education Committee. Jason Lewis of Winchester takes over as chair. State Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz of Jamaica Plain had chaired the panel for 8 years. She now will chair two other committees. The change comes as the legislature prepares for a major debate over school funding legislation. It is 36 degrees in Boston, sunshine today with a high around 40 degrees. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Tower Hill Botanic Garden, an indoor oasis to escape the bleak midwinter. Among lush conservatories, brimming with subtropical plants and flowers, towerhillbg.org. And Jewish Arts Collaborative with Taste of Israel Week, featuring Boston's Israeli and local chefs February 24th through March 2nd. Details at jartsboston.org.
Have you told a lie today? Psychologist Dan Ariely says dishonesty can be a sign of a creative mind.
Why do creative people cheat more? Because cheating is all about being able to tell a story about why what we want is actually okay.
Escaping the Truth, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 9 on 90.9 WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Craig Newmark Foundation, committed to the values of fairness, opportunity, and respect. The Newmark Foundation supports veterans and military families, voting rights, truth in journalism, and women in tech. And from Dreamwave, maker of luxury massage chairs from Japan. With shiatsu point detection and 16 programmed massages, including morning, night, and stretch sessions. Retailers nationwide. More at dreamwavechair.com.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. I wait every week to say it's time for sports. The NFL and Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reid have reached an agreement. Non-disclosure agreement, but we'll talk about it. Also, the debate in Cleveland over signing a player who shoved and kicked a woman in a hotel hallway. Here's Tom Goldman joined us. Tom, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
Colin Kaepernick's lawyer put out a statement on Twitter saying they had, quote, resolved pending grievances. Is that agent talk for they threw money at my client?
Well, we think so, but we don't know. Kaepernick and Eric Reid sued the NFL, claiming the league conspired to not hire them after their protest during the national anthem, as you remember, started by Kaepernick in 2016 to protest police brutality and racial injustice. Now, Yahoo Sports said it was told previously the players would only settle if a lucrative financial agreement was reached, but we don't know for sure because a confidentiality agreement, as you pointed out, is sealing everyone's lips.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask. Why didn't the NFL want the case to go to trial?
It's a big, powerful business. It doesn't like its inner workings exposed. So it makes sense the league didn't want this to go the distance. Last August, an arbitrator rejected the NFL's request to dismiss the case. A hearing was coming up, and there would have been potentially sensitive NFL material revealed. There was also the chance that even though collusion is hard to prove, Kaepernick and Reid might have had enough to win, and that would have been a huge PR hit for the NFL.
Does this necessarily mean Colin Kaepernick's going to be signed by any team?
We don't know. We really don't know at this point. It means perhaps that that he got a lot of money, but we just don't know at this point.
Moving on, Kareem Hunt has signed with the Cleveland Browns 2 months after he was cut by the Kansas City Chiefs when video surfaced of him shoving and kicking a woman. The NFL always says they won't tolerate players who commit domestic violence, but Kareem Hunt is just the latest linked to domestic violence to be signed, to get another chance.
Yeah, that's right. There is Joe Mixon in Cincinnati, Tyreek Hill in Kansas City. The NFL does have a, shall we call it a difficult history with this issue. In Hunt's case, though, Scott, this isn't simply a green light and you're back. He can't play until the NFL finishes investigating and decides on punishment. He's still facing multiple game suspension, and the Browns say they will have zero tolerance for any other incidents involving Hunt.
A great Cleveland sports writer, Mary Kay Cabot, wrote what you and I both read it, a very provocative column this week, in which she said, I'm going to paraphrase, look, Kareem Hunt grew up in a violent neighborhood near Cleveland. Many of his immediate family members, including his father and uncles, were in prison and are now. So is his mother. He needs help. He's getting it. He has a chance to turn this around. It could be a victory for victims of violence, for everyone he helps in the future.
Yeah, it was revealing and significant, as you say, that it was written by a woman. It's tricky because the NFL has this difficult history that we've talked about when it comes to domestic violence cases. And let's be clear, Scott, this isn't just altruism. The Browns are getting a great running back. He led the NFL in rushing as a rookie in 2017. But Hunt is getting another chance to move beyond this.
And we should explain he wasn't charged.
Right. He wasn't charged. And he's getting this second chance to move beyond this toxic world you talk about. Cleveland general manager John Dorsey reportedly is a religious man who believes strongly in Hunt's character and believes in that chance that the team's giving him.
Tom Goldman, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
To the ice rinks of Toronto now, where there are a lot.
In the 20-mile radius of downtown Toronto, there's at least 100 rinks.
Keith Hamilton is a musician, DJ, and ice hockey rent-a-goalie, a hired stick, if you please, for amateur ice hockey teams in need. Why the demand? Is there a goalie shortage? Keith Hamilton muses.
The equipment to play goalie is quite a bit more expensive than it is for a standard player. And I guess there's also not many people are super keen to stand in front of flying rubber pucks. They prefer to shoot them.
Wouldn't you? Mr. Hamilton estimates he's played more than 4,000 games in 8 years as a rent-a-goalie for $40 Canadian per game.
I'm very fortunate in this job that the hours are all over the place. So without having a standard 9-to-5 Monday to Friday, I can still log enough games for it to pretty much be a full-time job.
But Keith, $40 Canadian to risk getting a puck in your teeth? He says the flexible hours allow him to pursue a music career. He was parked outside of a hockey rink when we reached him.
I need 1 second here. I'm so sorry.
Rushing from one game to another.
There's a dump truck that was trying to get by. I had to move my vehicle. I just finished playing my third game of the day, and I have two more this afternoon.
In Toronto, hockey isn't just a game, it's the game. And if a team doesn't have a guy in the goal, they can't play the game.
The vast majority, they're just super grateful that I'm there. And if we play well, if we get a win, then they're even more grateful. But even if we lose, just the fact that they didn't lose the opportunity to play their game, They're always quite grateful. I help them save the game.
Keith Hamilton, or rent-a-goalie in Toronto. It's been 2 weeks since the governor of Virginia held an extraordinary press conference to take questions about a racist photo featured on his page in his medical school yearbook. The controversy caused a furor in Virginia, and it's prompted universities across the country to begin to examine their old yearbooks in search for offensive images. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
There have been all sorts of yearbook controversies over the years, often related to high schools. Sometimes there's outrage over inappropriate quotes or coded messages. It was a photo in a graduate yearbook, though, that caused Virginia's political explosion. A photo of a person in blackface and another in KKK robes on Governor Ralph Northam's yearbook page. Out on the Capitol steps in Richmond, a group of civic leaders said they supported Northam's decision not to resign. Former Richmond City Councilman Chuck Richardson says while he definitely doesn't condone them, such photos used to be pervasive in the past.
Look at all the yearbooks.
And some universities are or have already been doing just that, combing through all of their yearbooks. The Citadel and College of William and Mary in Virginia, Elon University in North Carolina, and Texas A&M are a few of them. Thanta Av, vice president of campus life at American University in Washington, D.C., says that school's yearbook, The Talon, was published from 1926 to 2009.
What we found from the review were about 15 photos and cartoons and drawings.
Photos of students in blackface, as well as racist images of Native Americans and Asian Americans. AV says a campus-wide memo sent out acknowledged what was found and emphasized the need for continuing education.
In situations like this, you have those who are well-versed on the issues and understand exactly the significance of this. And then you have a whole host of folks who are perplexed by it. And we want to make sure that people really understand what is the significance of this and why should you care.
At Wake Forest University in North Carolina, Jose Villalba, the school's chief diversity officer, says an audit of the school's yearbook, The Howler, actually began as part of a larger effort chronicling school history.
Well, we found a lot of pictures and some commentary that was offensive.
Blackface, racial remarks, and caricatures of lynchings in yearbooks from the 1920s through the 70s. Villalba says the university knew it needed to do better, and decades ago opened an Office of Minority Affairs, now called the Intercultural Center.
It's not a way of patting ourselves on the back, but it's a way of letting folks know that because we've been reflecting on these issues for a long, long time and trying to repair and do remedy by those issues, that's how we continue to have these dialogues.
These days, there are organizations that offer students and advisors yearbook help. Edmund Sullivan is the executive director of the Columbia Scholastic Press Association at Columbia University. It evaluates and rates yearbooks. He says today, students take a more journalistic approach when it comes to producing yearbooks, as opposed to treating it like a scrapbook, which leaves everything open to question.
The Northam page, for example, just was really a few snapshots under the person's name. There's no captions under the photos. There's no story or anything to try to place any context with what's on the page.
Sarah Nichols is president of the Journalism Education Association. That group works directly with student editors of yearbooks. She says even though controversies still flare up, today's students pay much more attention to ethics and standards because of the impact the yearbooks can have.
But really seeing these old yearbooks, it just illustrates what we in the scholastic journalism community have known all along, which is that yearbooks are forever.
As the controversy over the Virginia governor's medical school yearbook proves. Cheryl Corley, NPR News.
Bangkok Wakes to Rain is a novel that begins with short stories that wrap itself around a city that bristles with glimpses of different people inside that city. A woman whose name we don't know trudges through today's modern streets. An American doctor of the last century and protests of the 1970s that divide that city but bring a generation and two young people closer together. Bangkok Wakes to Rain is the debut novel from Pichaya Subantat, who divides his time between Bangkok and Brooklyn. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
You put a house at the center of this novel that gets surrounded by an actual skyscraper.
Yes. It's something that I connect to the simultaneous coexistence of both the ancient and magical and the new and technological. In Bangkok, where one sees sky trains and people on high-speed internet, and at the same time you see people making offerings to spirit houses on their land, or you walk the streets and see saffron robe monks waiting for almsgivers to give them food in the morning.
I'm haunted, which is not a word I try and use casually, but haunted by, I wrote it down, a signature line in this novel, quote, "The forgotten return again and again as new names and faces, and again this city makes new ghosts." Are the ghosts a sign of life and liveliness?
In some ways, a ghost is an unseen that's always present in a city that has so much that is tied to ancient history and also modernity. You know, for example, my family, when I go to visit them every year, we would make offerings to spirits who live on the land. Everything is still alive. Everything persists and stays within our own memory and lives, and also a greater life of this bustling, colorful metropolis.
The story begins to center on a woman named Ni. She meets Sitterpong, another young student, during the student demonstrations of the 1970s, a frightening time in so many ways. In any event, he sees Ni across a crowded protest meeting. She's come in from the rain. Take us back to that time, if you could.
Yeah, it's a very interesting time. I mean, I myself wasn't present for that. But when I was about 8 or 9 years old, I was giving my grandmother a massage in October, and she must have brought up the October massacres and how she had pleaded my aunt and uncle not to attend. There were protests, and they complied, which was fortunate for them because of the violence that ensued. And for me, that was something that stayed with me, and it's something that gestated and finally germinated into this thread that I wanted to explore in my novel.
Do Ney and Sitapong see hope in one another and then in the times?
I think they do. I think, like all young Thai people, they want something better for their country. And Thailand is a place of mass inequality where you see high-rises sprouting next to slum communities. You see luxury cars riding past scooters with a family of four all on it. So it's something that you can't help but write about.
There are an awful lot of lingering descriptions of food in this book, aren't there?
There are. You really cannot write about Bangkok or Thailand without writing about food. It's elemental to being Thai, I feel.
And what do you draw from that? When you try and write a novel that reveals some of the intricacy and delight and majesty of Thailand to people?
You know, I didn't have any preset plan to reveal anything. I was just basically following threads based on things I see when I visit Bangkok every year and go see my family. And I always think about me arriving at the airport, and on the car ride to home, I would just be confronted again by the city and the 24-hour traffic jams and the food stalls that's open at night and the smell of smoke. And there's a certain kind of alienation that I feel as a native who's returning. But then I get home and my mother has a bowl of rice soup with fish and garlic waiting for me. And then I feel like I'm back. And this is sort of the duality that I negotiate here in New York and there in Bangkok.
Another image that really struck me toward the end of the book, Ni takes fish before the fishmonger can, let me put this nicely, make them ready for sale. and she releases the fish into the river and wonder if they might lead her to someone. Maybe it's just Valentine's week, but that's the most achingly romantic thing I've read in a long while.
Yeah, it's the things we do to try to reach the people and places who are gone and away. And I think this novel is about people who are uprooted from places, from themselves, and from their history. And there are rituals that we perform so that for a moment we can become closer to those things.
Pichaya Subantad, his novel, Bangkok Wakes to Rain. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Babbel, an interactive language program that teaches travel, business, and casual conversation skills in a new language, like Italian. Available in the App Store or online at Babbel, BABBEL.com. And from Sotheby's Institute of Art, offering 2-week summer programs for high school students to experience the art world in New York. Teens visit museums, galleries, and auction houses to learn the history and business of art. Sotheby'sInstitute.com.
This is 90.9 WBUR and WBUR.org. Wait, Don't Tell Me is next at 10 o'clock.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by BU College of Fine Arts. The Opera Institute and School of Theater present Dolores Claiborne, February 21st through 24th, bu.edu/CFA. Always Health Partners, a fresh choice in health insurance with benefits and programs that put you first. Learn more at alwayshealthpartners.org, a member of Partners Healthcare. and De Cordova Sculpture Park and Museum, with 3 days of drop-in art making during February Vacation Week, February 20th through 22nd. More at decordova.org.
President Trump declares a national emergency to get the money he wanted for border walls. Democrats say they won't let Trump do an end run around Congress, and they'll see him in court. Also, junk science, we talked to a data buster about why it's so hard to debunk bad research, plus a view from space from NASA engineer Anne McLean on the International Space Station. Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 8 on 90.9 WBUR.
From Boston University, you're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston, home of Boston's largest radio newsroom, 92.7 WBUA Tisbury, 89.1 WBUH Brewster, and streaming at WBUR.org. WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.